Attention, attention, this is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 57 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This podcast is available in German and English on YouTube, Spotify and Podcast.de with a social media presence on Blue Sky and Instagram. Note for Spotify users, you can find the latest episodes on Spotify. For all episodes since the beginning, please visit podcast.de and YouTube.
The topic of this episode.
The year is 1923. Germany is on the brink of collapse. Reparations payments are crippling the young Weimar Republic. Hyperinflation is eroding citizens' savings, and the victorious powers are demanding their due. It is a time of national emergency, political chaos, and the deepest economic crisis Germany has ever experienced. Amidst these stormy seas, a man is appointed captain who is not actually a career politician, Wilhelm Kuno. The former director general of HAPAG, the Hamburg-American Package Shipping Company, takes the helm of the Reich. His reign lasted only 271 days, but it was formative. It was the time of the Ruhr struggle, the passive resistance against the French-Belgian occupation, a struggle that almost bankrupted Germany, but was also a last gasp of national dignity. In this episode, we delve into the chancellorship of Wilhelm Kuno, the crisis manager, the resistance fighter, and ultimately the man who had to crack a very tough political and economic nut in young German history. And broke under the pressure.
Political agenda and background.
None.
The sources that were used.
Source 1. Martin Sabrow, Violence Against Weimar, The Early Republic's Trials, 1918-23, Wallstein Verlag, Göttingen, 2023. Source 2. Nadine Rossol, Benjamin Ziemann, Upheaval and Abyss, The Handbook of the Weimar Republic. WBG, Darmstadt, 2021. Source 3. Hans Mommsen, The Rise and Fall of the Weimar Republic, 1918-33, Ullstein Propyläen, Berlin, 1998. Source 4. Bernd Braun, The Chancellors of the Weimar Republic, Kohlhammer Verlag, Stuttgart, 2013. Wilhelm Kuno was born on July 2, 1876 in Suhl. At that time, Suhl belonged to the Prussian part of Thuringia. His father was a Prussian officer, which is why Kuno moved a lot and never adopted a Thuringian dialect. On the contrary, he later adopted the dialect of his adopted home, Hamburg. Kuno's mother died when he was only 2 years old. His father remarried and Kuno gained a half-brother. After brief stays in Erfurt and Kassel, he moved to Königsberg at the age of 7, where he began his secondary education. At the age of 10, in 1886, he moved to Berlin. Since a Catholic upbringing was very important to his parents, he first attended the Dominican College in Venlo, Netherlands, and later the Theodorianum in Paderborn. He graduated from high school there in 1897. Kuno's family was Catholic and conservative, but not explicitly political. However, due to his upbringing, he was close to economically liberal and conservative circles. During the Weimar Republic, he tended primarily towards the DVP and DNVP. After graduating from high school, Kuno studied law and political science in Berlin and Heidelberg. He then worked at local and regional courts, while simultaneously attempting to complete his habilitation and remain active at the universities. All of this proved too much for him, and due to nervous exhaustion, what would now be called burnout, his habilitation remained unfinished. He instead embarked on a civil service career, transferring to the tax administration at the Imperial Treasury. There he rose through the ranks to the position of Privy Senior Government Counselor. Privy in this context signifies his position of trust within the agency, which allowed him access to classified files and participation in confidential deliberations. In this role, he drafted legislation, which he then presented to the Reichstag. In 1906, Kuno married Martha Wirz, the daughter of a wealthy merchant. They had 5 children, including 3 sons. During the First World War, he headed the Imperial Grain Office until July 1916 and then worked in the War Food Office. Because the supply situation was extremely strained due to the British naval blockade, this was a crucial position. Part of his job involved planning the reconstruction of the German merchant fleet, which had suffered greatly during the war. It was through this work that he met the Director General of the Harpak Shipping Company. In November 1917, Kuno took the plunge into the private sector, leaving his civil service career and joining Harpak. A year later, the Harpak Director General committed suicide in despair over the defeat in the war. In December 1918, Kuno succeeded him. Kuno succeeded in getting Harpak back on its feet. The shipping company had lost 178 ships, or 92% of its fleet, due to the war and its aftermath. Kuno saved the company from collapse and secured its survival through a cooperation agreement with United American Lines. Although Kuno was never actively involved in politics, he was known in political circles as an economic expert. His successes at Harpak also made a strong impression. As early as 1920-21, he was considered a possible candidate for Reich Finance Minister, but he declined. He participated as an expert at the 1922 Genoa Economic Conference. However, he left early in protest against the Treaty of Rapallo with the Soviet Union. Kuno had never run for office in an election or held any office or mandate. He also had no involvement in any socially relevant organizations. So why did he become chancellor? After the fall of Josef Wirth, President Ebert once again faced the difficult task of finding a chancellor. By November 1922, Germany had seen 8 governments and leaders collapse within just 4 years. Chancellor Max von Baden, Chancellor Friedrich Ebert, the revolutionary government of the SPD and USPD, Prime Minister Philipp Scheidemann and Chancellors Gustav Bauer, Hermann Müller, Konstantin Fehrenbach and Josef Wirth. It was clear that the position of Chancellor was a hot seat that no one truly wanted. Both the Center Party and the SPD refused to nominate a Chancellor. Finally, President Ebert turned to Wilhelm Kuno, whom he knew personally and held in high regard. Kuno became chancellor because, as a non-partisan figure with economic expertise and good connections in the USA and Great Britain, he was considered the ideal candidate. What were the expectations of him? Source 4 on page 90 provides a good summary. 3 hopes were linked to Kuno's appointment as chancellor. The non-partisan head of government was to act as a unifying figure across party lines. The successful manager was to help resolve the German Reich's financial crisis, and his international contacts, especially in the USA, were to advance the solution to the reparations issue. In short, Kuno was supposed to solve what all his predecessors had failed to do since 1918. The question is, wasn't he being asked to do a bit much? Kuno headed a cabinet comprised of the Center Party, the German Democratic Party DDP, and the German People's Party DVP. The fact that Kuno, who leaned more towards the right-wing conservative German National People's Party DNVP, included the left-liberal DDP in his coalition, further underscored his claim to be non-partisan. The Social Democratic Party SPD refused to join the government, despite pressure from President Ebert, but pledged to tolerate it. Thus, the government lacked a majority of its own, but at least secured a shaky majority through the SPD's support. Kuno's cabinet was also dubbed the Cabinet of Personalities, because he filled 4 ministries, Foreign Affairs, Food, Finance and Transport, with non-partisan men. This was the first cabinet to find favor with the right wing. Max von Stockhausen, a Reich Chancellery employee, later Franz von Papen's son-in-law and a DNVP sympathizer, wrote the following in his memoirs in 1954, which are reprinted in Source 4 on page 91. The difference between the old and the new leaders was striking. Wirth had been exclusively a politician and had viewed everything solely from a political, or rather a party political, perspective.
Kuno had hardly been politically active, remaining entirely the high-ranking expert of the old imperial ministerial bureaucracy, whose only aim was to conduct business in a strictly objective manner. The new leader, exceptionally handsome, tall and slim, was the epitome of an elegant man of the old school. The new cabinet made a good impression overall. The debate suddenly returned to a certain level.
It also helped that Kuno had good personal relations with Karl Helferich of the DNVP. Helferich, who had been a major thorn in the side of the Wirth government and had provoked 2 assassination attempts through his agitation, refrained from attacking the Reich government. In 1923, Kuno's wife Martha had official family photographs taken, bringing a touch of glamour to the Reich Chancellery. The couple was considered the most prestigious chancellor couple of the Weimar Republic, and Martha was regarded as the most beautiful chancellor's wife. However, Kuno achieved few results. His foreign policy overtures to France, to whom he proposed a non-aggression pact, were rejected. Likewise, his proposals regarding reparations, which were more or less a request for a deferral of payment, were also rejected. His efforts towards the United States were likewise unsuccessful. In line with the political right in the country, Kuno took a risk. He abandoned the policy of conditionally fulfilling the Allied demands, which his predecessor Wirth had pursued, and returned to a policy of obstruction. Source 2 states on page 75,
the former manager of the Harpak Shipping Company adopted the slogan "bread first, then reparations," and escalated the ongoing disputes over delaying reparations payments when he decided to also refuse to deliver goods, wood and coal.
However, he unwittingly played into the hands of French Prime Minister Poincaré. Poincaré had already announced in the summer of 1922 that he would henceforth take action in the Ruhr region even without British support. Source 1 describes Poincaré's plan on page 244 as follows.
The pretext to be used was Poincaré's claim that Germany, which was only in fact behind on individual deliveries, simply hadn't done enough to meet the Allies' reparations demands.
By his words and his decision to delay certain deliveries, Kuno provided Poincaré with precisely the justification the Frenchmen needed. On January 11, 1923, 45,000 French and Belgian soldiers crossed the Rhine bridges and occupied the Ruhr region. The number of occupying troops rose to over 90,000 within a few days. The British did not participate in this occupation, but they allowed the French and Belgians to cross through British-occupied territories. This indirect support further emboldened the French and Belgians. Source 1 continues on pages 244 and following.
Poincaré initially claimed that the military occupation was necessary to technically verify Germany's compliance with the reparations payments stipulated in the Treaty of Versailles. Hardly anyone believed him. Poincaré's position hardened over the course of the year, as the French, frustrated by the German policy of passive resistance that endangered the French economy, increasingly escalated their ambitions. The French Prime Minister was now moving ever closer to his original maximalist demand from 1919. The idea of a formally independent but de facto pro-French state in the Rhineland once again became a French objective. France's hawks even began to dream of permanently separating the entire Ruhr region from the German Reich.
Germany was unable to respond militarily to the occupation. The disarmed Reich, with its 100,000-man army, was incapable of doing so. Kuno therefore called for passive resistance. The Germans in the Ruhr region were to disobey the occupier's orders. Furthermore, he halted all reparations payments. Kuno thus had the overwhelming majority of the population and the Reichstag on his side. Originally, the passive resistance was intended to be a short-term show of force. Kuno hoped for devastating economic problems in France as a consequence. However, when these consequences proved far less severe than anticipated, he found himself in a dead end. Ending the resistance would have meant submission to the Allies, and rendered Kuno's actions pointless. But continuing the resistance led to even more conflict. Moreover, the economic consequences for Germany were far more devastating. Passive resistance was more or less a general strike in the Ruhr region. Large and small businesses, government offices, civil servants, miners, railway workers, simply everyone stopped working. The Reich government continued to pay the workers' wages and transferred compensation payments to the companies. This was only possible by taking on debt and printing money. The already weak economy spiraled out of control, the shaky currency collapsed, and inflation spiraled into insane levels. In January 1923, $1 was worth 10,000 Reichsmarks, but by May this had risen to 50,000, by July to 350,000, and by August to 4.6 million. By November, $1 was worth a staggering 4.2 trillion Reichsmark. This hyperinflation, still the nightmare of the Germans, wiped out all private wealth and deprived the German state of any options. Source 4 states on page 92, "The government failed to develop any viable solutions to the crisis. The chancellor, who stood above party politics, now had all parties against him and ultimately almost all Germans. In the face of the economic catastrophe, the initial national euphoria that had made Kuno the most popular chancellor in the Republic turned into despair, and Kuno became the most unpopular chancellor in the Republic. The government was caught off guard by the French-Belgian invasion. Warning signs were either not noticed or ignored. Besides passive resistance, Kuno primarily relied on British-American intervention and a shift in world opinion. These hopes, however, proved futile. Kuno insisted that ending passive resistance was impossible and would amount to submission, but it quickly became clear that no outside help was coming. And by the summer of 1923, it was evident that the resistance was crippling the German economy. Nevertheless, Kuno remained stubborn, hoping that France would be forced to capitulate before Germany. In his last speech before the Reichstag in early August 1923, he said, printed in Source 4 on page 92, "There is talk of negotiations with France. I consider this idea wrong and will explain why. The French demands primarily focus on the elimination of passive resistance. Before France even engages in discussion, before it states what it wants, the German government is supposed to lay down its only weapon. This is a demand the Reich government cannot accept." Even his own cabinet no longer supported him. In his memoirs, the then Reichswehr Minister Gessler doesn't mince words about Kuno, calling him a charlatan and the weakest chancellor of the Republic. While Kuno organized and financed passive resistance from Berlin, the situation on the ground in the Ruhr area escalated rapidly. Source 1 states on page 246, "Out of frustration with the initially unexpected stubborn refusal of the Germans to cooperate with their occupiers, the French and Belgians initiated the expulsion of German civil servants and their families, including railway workers, from the occupied Ruhr region. By the end of 1923, more than 100,000 civil servants and their families had been forced to leave the Ruhr, often under threat of armed force. The border between the occupied Ruhr region and unoccupied Germany was temporarily closed. Such disruptions restricted the food supply in the Ruhr region and exacerbated the already precarious situation for the poorest inhabitants. Children suffered most. Up to 300,000 children were transported to unoccupied Germany to obtain food. Had they remained in the Ruhr region, an unknown number of them would have starved to death." The French also quickly attempted to implement the secession of the Ruhr region, as mentioned, the dream of the French hawks. German names and symbols were removed and banned and replaced with French names, for example, for streets. The German population was required to greet French officers, salute the French flag, and give French soldiers the right of way. Failure to comply with these orders resulted in severe punishments. It was a reversal of the situation that had existed in Belgium and northern France during the First World War. The deployment of North African colonial soldiers by the French was particularly controversial. While it was never definitely established whether the use of these soldiers was intended as a deliberate act of humiliation for racist reasons, source 1 is certain that this was at least implicitly the case. Quote from page 247. In any case, it is considered almost certain that the Germans were to be deliberately humiliated in this way. The presence of non-white soldiers was intended not only to symbolize Germany's defeat within the European state system, but also to underscore the end of Germany as a white European power. From the beginning of February, the occupying soldiers became significantly more aggressive towards the population in an attempt to break the resistance. It wasn't long before violence erupted under these circumstances. Source 1 describes an incident on page 250. The most notorious incident occurred on March 31, 1923, when a young French lieutenant named Durieux led a group of soldiers into the Krupp factories in Essen. His task was to requisition vehicles for the French military. Around 11 a.m., as Durieux led his men out of the vehicle hall to deal with a large crowd of protesting German workers, his men opened fire. German and French statements present conflicting accounts of the exact sequence of events, but it remains undisputed that there were no French casualties. On the German side, however, 13 demonstrators lost their lives. In addition to such deaths, civilians, including women, children, and the elderly, were regularly subjected to beatings with rifle butts and whippings. Furthermore, the number of rapes increased significantly. German journalists present described the actions of the occupying soldiers as tyranny. It is, of course, understandable that under such circumstances, public sentiment in Germany was not inclined to give in. In August 1923, an incident occurred that even the French government found objectionable. French soldier Henri Pech made indecent advances toward a married German woman in a café in Herne. When her husband tried to protect her, Pech stabbed him with his bayonet. The man later died from his injuries. Pech received only a 2-year suspended sentence. This was too lenient even for Poincaré. According to source 1, page 252, he commented on the incident as follows. The victims were harmless civilians. The soldiers' actions are inexcusable, and the serious consequences of these actions have damaged public opinion and tarnished the reputation of our soldiers. This violent approach could not remain without consequences in the long run. Although the Reich government could not respond with troops or police, there were enough right-wing nationalist groups that became active, sometimes with the support of the Reich government. Source 1 describes these actions on page 252. These covert operations included gangster-style executions in public squares and terrorist bombings on railway lines or the planting of hidden explosives in railway carriages. The most spectacular bombing of a train took place on June 30, 1923, and resulted in 20 deaths and numerous serious injuries. When the Belgian public learned that soldiers returning home from the Ruhr had been killed by a bomb hidden on a train, the Belgian willingness to engage in cultural demobilization decreased dramatically. Instead, there was support for harsher measures against Germany and discussions about preventative security measures, such as using prominent Germans as human shields who would be employed as train conductors. At the end of May 1923, the French executed Albert Leo Schlageter, a former Freikorps soldier and member of the Nazi Party. In doing so, they created a martyr within the Nazi ranks. By the summer of 1923, passive resistance had effectively failed. The situation in the Ruhr was dire and acts of violence on both sides were escalating. The British admission in August 23 that the occupation of the Ruhr was illegal was of no use to anyone by that point. The German economy was in ruins and the currency had collapsed and become virtually worthless. Passive resistance no longer garnered widespread support, and once again the Germans had to accept defeat. 5 days after his last speech in the Reichstag, Wilhelm Kuno was replaced by a grand coalition under the DVP politician Gustav Stresemann. Kuno left the new government with unresolved problems that threatened the survival of the Republic and the very existence of Germany. Hyperinflation, in particular, created unprecedented conditions. Quote from Source 2, page 176. After the realization took hold in the summer of 1923 that the mark was beyond saving, retailers also began refusing to accept paper marks and artificially restricting and hoarding goods. Shops opened only 2 or 3 days a week, eventually only for a few hours, and even then the selection remained inadequate. Queuing in front of grocery stores became commonplace. At the same time, farmers refused to meet their delivery quotas, which dated back to the post-war period of rationing. Supply crises and hunger riots ensued. Hoarding and field theft were rampant. Looting was no longer uncommon. In many cases, wages fell so low that it became impossible for working-class families to buy everyday necessities. Money was handed out by the baskets and lost value so quickly that you had to buy something with it immediately. What you received in the morning was worthless by evening. Money was also sometimes used as fuel or wallpaper. Eventually, banknotes were overprinted with new denominations or printed only on one side. What happened to Wilhelm Kuno after his resignation? The former chancellor, only 47 years old, returned to Harpag. There he was successful once again and continued the restructuring of the company. By the end of the Weimar Republic, Harpag was almost as strong as it had been before the outbreak of the First World War. Kuno remained an internationally respected figure and was received at the White House by 3 US presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. Politically, Kuno moved further and further to the right. In 1925, he supported Paul von Hindenburg in the presidential election. In 1930-31, he was briefly considered as a replacement candidate for Hindenburg, but nothing came of it. When in November 1932 big business called on President Hindenburg to appoint Adolf Hitler as chancellor, Wilhelm Kuno was not among those who supported this idea. However, he never actually had to take a clear stance on the Nazis. On January 3, 1933, about 4 weeks before the Nazis seized power, Wilhelm Kuno died of a heart attack. After her husband's death, Martha Wirz moved to Hamburg. There she survived the heavy air raids of 1943, but lost almost all of her husband's mementos. One of Kuno's sons was killed in action in 1941. Kuno's widow died in Hamburg in 1963. His youngest daughter Kathleen lived to be 90 and died in 2012.
A few finishing words.
Kuno is a tragic figure in Weimar history. His legacy is the Ruhr struggle, the courage to passively resist the occupation of Germany's industrial heartland. While the struggle briefly strengthened national unity, the political and economic costs were enormous. Hyperinflation exploded uncontrollably and almost led to the collapse of the state. His resignation in August 1923 marked the end of a government that, while resolute, had responded to the challenges without offering solutions. He thus paved the way for the Grand Coalition under Gustav Stresemann, which would ultimately bring about a turning point. As a businessman, Kuno was successful. As a politician, he was not. Kuno remains the symbol of the desperate attempt to save the fledgling democracy through national resistance, a struggle that, however honorable its intentions, brought the country to the brink of collapse.
Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.